you have to start thinking about, like, how can this actually bring out something new in me? Like, how could this bring out my best? What would a new and better way of doing this look like? Those are completely liberating questions because they get you unblended from the prediction, the negative prediction. And they will train your predictive networks to now automatically see this in a more positive way.
Before we get started, if you enjoy these episodes, you might want to explore more at optimorc.com. Our website offers unique content, tools, and exercises to help you thrive at work and beyond. We have an in-depth masterclass which covers our entire theory of growth. We have daily recommendations for personalized advice, and we have a platform to help groups and organizations learn and practice optimal work together. You can get a free trial at optimorc.com. Now let's get started with today's episode. Hey, this is Sharif here with another episode of the Optimal Work Podcast, joined by Dr. Kevin Majors. Kevin, good to be back here with you again.
Hey, Sharif, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, Kevin, it's great to be here with you again. At the end of last episode, we talked a little bit, the whole episode was on IFS, and I asked you the question towards the end, because Optimal Work is about, you know, CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, that IFS seems to be very cognitive focused. So I asked you about, you know, what's the behavioral dimension of IFS, if any, or how it relates to what we do in Optimal Work, helping people improve their actions, their behaviors. And, you know, we didn't have enough time to fully discuss that. So I thought we could dive a little bit more into that this episode.
Yeah, I think it's a great starting point to kind of review how does IFS even fit in the kind of context of helping people in psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm. And then I think we can also explore a little bit how IFS relates to our model of anxiety, because that's kind of really, really key here in understanding, you know, the vicious cycles people might fall into, or the good behaviors people can mm-hmm. adopt to start building virtuous that's right. cycles.
Yeah, that's right. So the idea that you mentioned there of virtuous cycles, that has to be somehow where the gravity is. And the gravitational pull needs to always be, is a therapy helping people build up a virtuous cycle? So that's one thing we'll have to look at. But I think with the vicious cycle, you know, just taking the case that we've done a series on anxiety, and the fundamental thing of how the amygdala works is, you know, the amygdala detects a threat, sounds the alarm, and then watches your response, looking for signs of approach or avoidance. So what happens when people have, say, an anxiety disorder, is that the detecting of threats takes on, you could say, a little bit of life of its own. So they have a worrier inside who is just always on the lookout for threats, or a perfectionist, or an inner critic, or an achieving part. But it's always on the lookout for threats of a particular kind. So there's this hyper-awareness of threats that becomes embedded, you could say, in the person's way of looking at the world. So, and that's very important. So you could talk about these proactive protectors that people have, like the worrier, the scrupulous part, as simply a way of continually monitoring for threats. So that fits with really the first thing the amygdala does, detect threats. And then the second thing the amygdala does, sounding the alarm, well, that corresponds then to the actual emotion that gets triggered. So when people are worrying, well, they're worrying to escape anxiety, but ends up triggering anxiety. When people have obsessions or perfectionism, it ends up triggering anxiety. That's the alarm, the second step. And that's what IFS calls the exile. And then the presence of that is what swings the firefighter into action. So there's some way then of escaping this activation. So it could be by drinking. It could be by, you know, taking Xanax. It could be by isolating oneself and avoiding people or challenges. So you have these escape strategies, right? And so that corresponds to the watching the response for signs of escape. So the three kinds of parts that people have, a part that's on the lookout, a part that is the anxiety itself or the emotion itself, and then the part that's the escaper to respond, That's just built in to how the amygdala works. And that is the nature of a vicious cycle. Because if you keep escaping something, it just confirms for the parts that are on the lookout that this is a real threat. And then they're more likely to sound the alarm. So people can get caught in this entire vicious cycle where a negative view of the challenge leads to a negative emotion experienced as negative, which leads to this kind of negative escape strategies, which can feel like a trance, what I call the negative trance, where they just feel like there's a tunnel vision. They just have to do it until it's gone. And then they get stuck. So that's the vicious cycle in IFS terms.
Before we continue, a brief message. If you're benefiting from these discussions, please hit like and subscribe to our channel. Doing so helps us reach more people. So you're not just learning yourself, you're helping others discover a path to growth and flourishing too. Thanks so much for your support. Enjoy the rest of the episode. So Kevin, in this model, so you have the amygdala, which is kind of scanning everything you see, experience, think, you know, looking for threats. And then mm-hmm. when it detects a threat, you know, the trigger of anxiety, it's going to sound the alarm. And I think we often say that sounding of the alarm, which is kind of the part of that is the adrenaline response. That's like the feeling of anxiety. But then what you just related it to was the exile in IFS. And my understanding of the exile is that the exile can be different emotions that you're unwilling to experience, you know, depending on mm-hmm. who you are, your history, or what you've been avoiding or whatever. Mm-hmm. But that the feeling of anxiety is rather consistent across people. So I'm wondering how you, or actually, is that a wrong assumption? Are there kind of different flavors of anxiety depending on the exile that's kind of, you know, been exiled or that you're unwilling to experience?
Yeah, this is a great question. I guess what I'm trying to see here is that, or show, is that you have this negative prediction strategy, looking for threats on hyper alert. You have then the experienced negative emotion of whatever kind. And then you have the negative escape strategy. So this is all the result of being caught in this negative model. And IFS talks about being blended or unblended. So when you're unblended, you're in reality. But when you're blended, you just see things stuck in these viewpoints of you're the worrier and then feeling the anxiety and struggling with that, or feeling the desperate need to escape it. Especially, it's desperate if you can't really escape it. All of that is actually imaginary. That is all the result of modeling that the brain does for threats. So these parts in IFS are not real. Like they're implicit strategies that have been learned over time and are now called upon. IFS is a very clever, quasi-hypnotic way of dialoguing and dealing with them. And that can be extremely freeing for people. But what you're really helping them to directly deal with are these overused strategies based on the negative model of a particular challenge. So everything in IFS, or everything you could say that a part has an agenda in a way. The warrior in you, its agenda is to somehow get to peace and certainty. And so it's totally unwilling to feel anxious. But that unwillingness to feel the anxiety is what drives its worry. And that's also what drives the compensating escape behaviors. You know, maybe people seek reassurances from others all the time, or they feel the need to apologize all the time. So there's these escape strategies that people can have, and they can feel really desperate, like they have to do it. And that just confirms the worrier. And that's how you get the vicious cycle. It's interesting then, when you're looking at what is real here, okay, what's really happening is what we know is like in the body taking place is the amygdala detects a threat. No, the amygdala detects a challenge. And then it gives adrenaline so that you can meet the challenge. And then it watches your response to see what you do. And if you use it for the fight or flight response, then it's going to increase the sense that that's a challenge in the future because you fought it or fled it. So the amygdala doesn't have any modeling really involved. It doesn't have a kind of negative or positive casting, you could say. This is my best kind of reading of what's happening here. It doesn't have a, it's just that it detects a challenge and gives you adrenaline. if you view that habitually through this negative lens, it's really a left-brained negative lens. It's a model you've created. You experience then the adrenaline as anxiety. But that's not fundamentally what it is. So you could say that really it's like anxiety is always a negative predicted emotion. It exists as a prediction and kind of explains one way of how to experience adrenaline itself. So that's why I say like anxiety is just adrenaline with a negative spin. It means it's viewed through the lens of this negative modeling.
So if the amygdala is just detecting a challenge and giving you adrenaline to meet that challenge, what's the sense in which it actually needs to be retrained? Like, isn't that just a good process?
To give you the right amount of adrenaline. So when you have a panic attack, that's probably more adrenaline than you need for whatever the actual challenge is. So you can have these glitches that occur where now you're getting, or you're getting chronic activation of your sympathetic nervous system. We should remember that these proactive protectors that are always on the lookout for threats, the more we're blended with them, the more we're confirming their worries by kind of believing it as being somehow like not questioning the model. So the more you're doing that, the more your whole threat system is then chronically activated because now you're in this threat mode. Threat mode is a state of chronic sympathetic activation caused by this overactive detecting of threats. So, and then you have chronically high cortisol. So when people feel depleted because of, you know, like their struggles with emotion, that depletion is really cortisol staying too high for too long. Cortisol is great for a brief burst of a challenging thing. So that might last a few days or a week. It's not great as a way of living. Because cortisol over time will shear off the little twigs of your neurons. So your neurons get stubbier. It turns down your immune system. It worsens your digestive health and your skin health. It has all of these chronic effects, right? So that'd be a whole nother topic to talk about, like what does cortisol do in a chronic state? So all of that is unnecessary, but it's what happens when people are stuck in this negative view of their current situation, the negative prediction leading to the negative emotion leading to the negative behaviors that follow automatically.
Yeah. So I kind of want to follow up on this negative prediction issue because I think a lot of times what we say is, okay, it's not that your brain is like not working or your brain needs to be fixed or something. It's just that it's responding to your previous behavior. So like with the amygdala or with anxiety, that your amygdala, it's not like you want to remove your amygdala from your brain and like throw it out and then you'll get over your anxiety and you'll be fine. But it's really your amygdala is giving you adrenaline to help you engage the challenge. So it's mm-hmm. just something about like the framing or how you're using the adrenaline that needs work.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering how that relates to the negative predictions, because it seems like, hey, these negative predictions are always bad. Like, we need to figure out what part mm-hmm. of the brain produces them and then just like, you know, rip it out and throw it away. And then, you know, and then we'll be a lot happier. So how do we use these predictions and maybe these negative predictions?
I think if you did that, you'd probably be unable to move the entire right side of your body.
Okay.
Because it would mean getting rid of the entire left hemisphere.
Okay.
So the nature is that the modeled reality is the lens that we use through our left hemisphere. The actual direct sensation of reality is the domain of the right hemisphere. The right hemisphere is aware of the entire body. The left hemisphere is aware of, well, the right half, but actually more than that, it's more parts. So if your whole, like when people are really blended, let's say with the warrior, they might notice that their shoulders are tight, you know, or there's a tightness, there's a lump in their throat, or there's a pit in their stomach. That's all characteristic what happens when we're blended with the models. The model like limits us. The more aware we are of the entire body, then in fact, the more in the right brain we are, because the right brain can be aware of the whole body simultaneously. That's actually a whole nother topic of how do you stay in that right hemisphere? But it really relates. Like we have a model and we have reality. What we want is for the model to get closer and closer at approximating reality. The problem is all the models we have for the problems we face are based on old data. We need this capacity for curiosity and engagement in the present moment to be thinking of the challenges that we're facing in a new way. And that's what we always think of in optimal work. Like, how do I approach this challenge in my life in some kind of new creative way? What would that look like? That is how you recruit the whole right hemisphere to now do the work of shaping the modeling of the left. IFS is a really clever way of doing it, that you actually just show curiosity and compassion for these models themselves. So like when you experience the warrior really, you know, like fretting over something coming up, to be curious about that and compassionate with it is actually a way of connecting it back to the right hemisphere. So what they call true self. So it's very powerful.
How do you harness these models? Because it seems like what you're saying a little bit is you want to be engaged with reality, and that always means getting past the models. Yeah. Is that like going against your models, overcoming your models, kind of like resisting them, and so that you can engage reality? Or is there some way that you can actually, you know, harness your brain's predictions and these models that it's that those predictions are based on? And really, I mean, as you mm-hmm. think. The predictions are emotions too. So there's some sense of like harnessing the emotion to act well, right?
Yeah. So what we need to do then is be able to first get the cognitive element right, you know, because that can be captured by the negative prediction. So, but you do that by reframing, widening the context in which you're viewing the present task in front of you, the present challenge in front of you, or the difficulty you're facing, whatever it is, what you do is you have to start thinking about like, how can this actually bring out something new in me? Like, how could this bring out my best? What would a new and better way of doing this look like? Those are completely liberating questions because they get you unblended from the prediction, the negative prediction. And they will train your predictive networks to now automatically see this in a more positive way. So you want the modeling to be working, because when the model works perfectly, you will go into flow the moment you engage that challenge, because you'll be able to give it your entire attention. And in the background, this predictive network is going to get the next thing ready for you and the next thing after that. And then you can go into flow as you go through it. So there is a sense that what we talk about is a golden hour. Is the goal, that's precisely how you train the system. So you reframe. Mindfulness lets you engage with the energy directly, unlike just seeing it through the lens as anxiety, let's say, or shame. What you experience instead is just the energy of the adrenaline allowing you to better engage this task right now. So that's so crucial, right? That you learn how to let go of the unwillingness you might have to experience a certain emotion and instead purely experience the readiness for work that's underlying it. The readiness for work, the readiness for love, the readiness for even play. That readiness for real life, real people, real bonds, real ideals, all of those things are entirely right-brained, right? And so that's what we're allowed to do when we can experience what had been experienced as negative emotion like anxiety in this new way without judging it as bad. Let go of the unwillingness. And that also means then letting go of escape strategies, which would only confirm the negative predictions, creating a vicious cycle, self-fulfilling prophecies. And instead then chart out the course for engaging this step by step in advance if you can, finding your way to really embrace the quality challenge step by step. So that's what actually makes it real. Reframing and mindfulness can take place in advance, but the challenge is really step by step proceeding through it to grow with it.
Okay, good. I think I'm finally getting it, which is that the predictions are good if they're accurate, and yes, helpful, but they're bad if they're wrong, right? So you want to exactly. Defuse from these bad predictions and train your brain with your behaviors to create new and better, more accurate predictions.
I think that is exactly right. It's interesting too when you think of it. Just when you think of, like, you know, people using medication to treat these things, we have these three levels: the cognitive, the emotional, the behavioral, detecting threats, feeling the alarm, then approaching or avoiding. That's also how psychiatric medicines work. So, because that first set, the cognitive part, is entirely serotonin. This is our best guess right now. So when you give serotonin reuptake inhibitors, what you're actually doing is affecting those proactive protectors, you know, that are on the lookout for threats, to let them not be so much on the lookout. So that whole network, that whole, like, negative modeling relaxes a bit. And that's why sometimes that's all people need. Once you relax that whole predictive network, you release it from its negative processing bias, where it just automatically saw challenges as threats, and now it can more easily engage these. Well, that's the benefit of an SSRI. So those are very typically used. I think that reframing does the work of an SSRI. And it's better because it's something you can learn to flexibly deploy as needed. And then you have medicines that just knock out the alarm. Valium, Xanax, alcohol. So probably marijuana to some extent. These are things that just directly calm the sounding of the alarm and put it back into arresting your amygdala, kind of forcibly into a resting state. I think those are always bad strategies. So I think that the alarm is not the problem, right? It's part of the vicious cycle, but it's not that it's working improperly. And then finally, you have the escape strategies, where people get this tunnel vision, and that's where naltrexone works, and probably other blockers, like what opioid blockers would do the same, but I've never seen those used, where you can actually help people just prevent the tunnel vision. You can give medicines to just stop the negative trance. And that allows people then to be able to more willingly feel the alarm sounding. But still, that doesn't really do a whole lot more than just, like, building up a habit of mindfulness does. So I think the reframing, mindfulness, quality challenges are actually, they are the best medicine. And they do it not by treating these things as if they're broken, but just by retraining them so that they actually help you to work better and to have better bonds with people, better connection with people.
Yeah. Kevin, I have one kind of last question for you, which is, okay, so we've been talking about anxiety and relating it to IFS, and then also talking about your brain's models and the negative predictions and how that all fits in. One thing that you've always said about anxiety, which I've found interesting, is that people with anxiety are ready for, like, a major flip. Like, it's really, there's a lot of maybe untapped growth, you could say. And so sometimes they can experience a very big change in a very short amount of time. So I'm wondering, because it seems like normally the process of changing one's habits, kind of flipping vicious cycles into virtuous cycles, you would think, hey, this takes a lot of work. It's like every day you make a little bit of progress. But I'm wondering, in your experience, like, why that flip, how that works. And maybe, I don't know if there's anything in terms of these predictions or the IFS of, like, how that explains it.
Mm-hmm. I think that they have, when people have very high levels of anxiety, what we know that they have is amygdala that's working just fine, maybe mistrained, but it is working. It's giving them plenty of adrenaline. So adrenaline at high levels, think of a car stuck on the side of a highway. You know, it's like in the desert. There's no one around to help. And the person is just revving the engine with the car in neutral. And they're getting more and more desperate because the car is not moving. So, and they keep revving the engine higher and higher and higher and higher. So what you can do is, once people learn that, wait, this revving of the engine is not the problem, right? It could be the entire solution. All you need to do is put the car in drive. Once you put the car in drive, now it can do work. It can actually, and then it will drive the work forward. And then you could be zooming on the highway again. So the fact that the car's engine was able to rev so much is just a sign that, yeah, this car is ready for work, but it has to be in drive. And anxiety, when people are suffering from high anxiety, is the engine revving in neutral. You need a stretch goal. some kind of quality goal that transcends yourself. Ideally, that's the highest way where you can see that only with the help that adrenaline is giving you can you really stretch yourself in this way. And once you have that, you can feel the flip where now it just helps you. So if, say, like a concert, say a tenor is, you know, has this aria where he has to hit this super high note and sustain it. Well, once he has learned to channel the adrenaline in such a way that it just helps him hit that high note, well, after that, he's not going to be concerned at all about how high his adrenaline is getting leading up to it. He just knows it's on board and it's ready. You know, and so I think it's the problem isn't the adrenaline. The problem is it needed a destination, a stretch goal, a purpose, a telos. It needed that. And with that now, it causes this huge flip and people make huge progress in life.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, hey, Kevin, that's all I got for you today.
Hey, Sharif, thanks for the questions. Fun.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. If you enjoyed our conversation and you're looking for more in-depth guidance, check out optimalwork.com. Our platform of content, tools, and exercises that will help you thrive at work and beyond. See you next week.